There's a lot I want to share with you tonight. I'm going to use the board here. I'll move it around in a minute so that people can see it. If I don't get tangled up here in the cord and can't get around, I'll be all right. I want everyone to understand, first of all, my purpose in being here tonight and why. Why in the world did I come to Iowa today to talk about this subject? I work in the Department of Interfaith Witness at the Southern Baptist Home Mission Board in Atlanta, Georgia. I am a consultant dealing with things like Unification Church, Hare Krishnas, several new groups that are springing up in our country that there's a lot of questions being asked about. A lot of people are being approached, and it's something that I think that we need to understand as citizens, as Christians, as all kinds of people, as students especially, because I'm finding that in my experience with the Unification Church, and I guess the reason I am the consultant at the department at this point is because I had an experience, a 2.5 year experience with the Unification Church. And so I want to share some of those things with you tonight in the form of an experience that I've had. And I'm not here to form the Iowa City Anti-Moon Association. I'm not here to teach anybody how to hate anybody else. But I think that in sharing and in asking questions and in understanding, once you begin to deal with this situation, I think you see that there's a lot more that about the Unification Church than will meet the eye on the surface. I'm sure that probably all of us at one time or another have been approached in a parking lot or in our homes or on a street corner or something by someone who is active. They come up with a bucket of flowers, a box of candy, a smile on their face, and we'll talk about some program they're supporting in your area, and we'll be very interested in trying to get a donation out of you. We see a lot of this in the major cities, especially in the South. And I live out of Atlanta, Georgia now. I travel an extensive amount. I guess in the last year I've traveled about 100,000 miles, doing basically what I'm doing here tonight, from groups this size to groups as large as 30,000, because it's a subject that concerns, it seems to be concerning, a wide range of people. Parents, they're scared. They don't know what's happening inside. Parents who've got their children inside the Unification Church, they're worried. They don't know what's going on. They're being attracted, or people that are called deprogrammers are often showing up on their doorsteps and saying, we understand your child is in the Unification Church, and we can offer you a service to get your child out. And so one thing I want to discuss tonight is this thing called deprogramming. Number one, I was never deprogrammed. My parents hired deprogrammers, but I came out on my own. And I'm going to share some things about deprogramming tonight that I personally feel. A lot of opinions I'll discuss are mine, and I don't want to, I don't want you to think I'm going to be here and cram down your throat my viewpoints and want you to believe just exactly the same thing that I believe. Number one, I stand for religious liberty in this country. Unification Church, Hare Krishna, Southern Baptists, Roman Catholics, we can all believe in God in the way that we want. I'll preserve their right to believe in God just as long as I would preserve my own right, because I don't want anyone to ever take it away from me. So I'm not here to challenge their right to believe in God the way they want to. But what I'm here to do tonight is talk about several things. Number one, I'm going to center this whole thing in my experience, in what happened to me, how I was met, how I was wooed, how I joined, what happened to me, situations that will involve people with the likes of Richard Nixon. I worked very actively with a group called Freedom Leadership Foundation in Washington, D.C. I worked in the White House. I traveled with the president on several occasions. The Unification Church made a big plea or a big effort to support the president during his last few months in office. And some of the things that happened, I think, are startling. These people that come fundraising up to you, there are several things. Number one, you're going to be, I think, surprised at the amount of money that they earn, as well where all the money is going, and oftentimes contrary to where they're telling you the money's going in the first place. Thirdly, the outlook. Who is this man Moon? What's motivating him? What's the bottom line of membership in the Unification Church? And explain to you a little bit about their theology. We don't have time to go into it. It takes hours to get into it. But I want to explain to you as best I possibly can an overview of what they believe. And I think the bottom line of what I want to do tonight is not, again, start an anti-moon association, not get you so worked up that you want to go out and lynch Unification Church. That's not my purpose. But I hope that you'll learn to love these people, because I think that as individuals, as humans, as Christians, as whatever your faith might be, we have got something that we've got to share. And I think that there's been some misunderstanding. Some of the things that we read in newspaper articles, in magazine articles about the Unification Church is scandalous, and in many times is flat untrue. But I think there's enough truth that can be examined and discussed that we should seriously examine who this group is. So I want to take this matter seriously, prayerfully, and in a manner of exploring more than anything else. I'm going to give you a chance to ask questions, but I want to discuss with you, too, my own personal spiritual pilgrimage. I think we all have our own personal spiritual pilgrimage and how this has affected my life. I don't hate the Unification Church. I'm not out on vengeance against them. I don't feel like they're not threatening my life. I get asked that question probably every time when I'm out. Doesn't the Unification Church try to threaten your life? Don't they come up and try to stop you? Well, there's been efforts to try to stop me, and several people have had several things to say in the form of newspaper articles, letters, things like that, to try to discredit me, to make me sound less credible. I'm not here to up my credibility either. In fact, it's not about me that I'm here. It's more for you, because close to 80% of the members of the Unification Church come off of college campuses, and in that age category. And most of them, by far the majority, fall between the ages of 20 and 30. And of that group, well over half grew up in a Christian background, grew up in a Christian home of some sort. About 20% grew up in a Jewish home. And so leaving probably 15% at most that never had any kind of religious background whatsoever. And so it's the usually the person on campus who's had some sort of religious background who gets involved. A lot of people think, oh, it's only starry-eyed, spaced-out people who have no purpose or direction in their life that get involved. That simply is not true. Most of the people that are involved, and when I met them, impressed me. But what they had to offer, and for the reasons in which I joined, I want you to go through the experience with me and feel a lot of the things I felt and see if you don't come up with some of the same conclusions that I do. I'm going to take just not a whole long time and present a lot of these ideas to you and a lot of these things and a lot of the conclusions that I have drawn because of my experience, and then give you as much time. I think we have another meeting after this. I can't give you all evening, but to let you ask questions. Any question you see fit, I'll do my best to try to answer. But I want you to understand that we're going to just discuss the subject. We're going to talk about it. And if you'll give me a chance to do the presentation, I think you'll see that there's a lot of material to be discussed. We could talk all night about it. The first time I ever discussed this with my present employers, the Home Mission Board in Atlanta, we talked endlessly, well, about 8 hours a day for 4 days, because there's a lot of material to be discussed. It's a big subject. I think the most startling thing, first of all, to realize about the Unification Church is the number of people that are involved. Because in a sense, our newspapers have become shocked. They're out after a sensational story oftentimes. And everywhere I go, towns as small as Buffalo, Oklahoma, or Artesia, New Mexico, or Sophia, West Virginia, or little towns, no matter how little the town I go to, they always say, we've had them here. They've been here. And everyone seems to think that that group that was there fundraising in their town lives in their town. And they're looking around to see where these people live. Well, one thing about a great percentage of the Unification Church is that it's mobile. And it's involved in a thing called an MFT, Mobile Fundraising Team. And that the full-time membership in this country is shockingly low. Surprisingly low, considering the impact they're having. And I think it's something that's indicative of their dedication, of their loyalty, of the kind of efforts that they're making. And in many ways, I've learned a tremendous amount about what it means to be dedicated. I was raised a Baptist in Carlsbad, New Mexico, way out in the boondocks out there. and a very active home. My family was very active in church. We never missed a Sunday going to Sunday school. I was at the University of Arizona in the summer of 1973 as senior, president of my fraternity, active in college political organizations. One afternoon, a guy walked up to me out of the clear blue. I was pretty much minding my own business. I was sitting on the porch of my fraternity house reading economics. A guy walked up to me and began to tell me several things. Now, first of all, I looked up over my book, and there that guy was standing there. He took me by surprise from the beginning, and he had his hand extended. The first things I noticed about him was that he was extremely clean cut. He had on a shirt and tie, and had the biggest smile I had ever seen. Now, I just looked up, and his bright, beaming face was looking down at me, and so I got up, shook hands with him, talked with him for a few minutes. He told me he was working with a group of young people, and he called it the International One World Crusade, and that this crusade was working all over the world, but particularly in America, in order to bring about a revival in this country of the goals that this country was originally set up to stand for. That they were working in five major fields, he said: religion, politics, economics, culture, and the sciences. And said that God shouldn't only be working in religion, but he should be working in all of these things. And it sounded good to me. We talked for about 30 minutes. Now, the culmination of this whole conversation was a question he asked me. He said, "Chris, will you come to a lecture with me tonight?" Now, I'm sure everyone in here can identify that it was not the lure of going to another lecture that I went with him. I didn't often attend all the lectures I was paying to go to school for in the first place, but this guy had something to offer, I felt like. He seemed to be so into what he was doing, and he wanted to share something with me that I felt like I wanted to hear. Now, there was never any mention from the beginning of a man named Sun Myung-moon or Unification Church, but this was 1973, and Moon hadn't gotten to be very well known. He could have mentioned it to me, and I probably would not have known who he was talking about at the time. He wanted me to come to a lecture with him, and he wanted me to come right then, not later on that evening, giving me a chance to slip out and not show up, but he wanted me to come with him right then. And so I went. We walked across the campus, and here I was in my cutoffs and t-shirt and the typical college style. And this guy had on a shirt and tie and a coat and long pants and clean cut, and I felt really out of place walking across the campus with him. And as we walked across, he stopped suddenly and looked me in the eye, and he was from London, by the way, and I was very impressed with that British accent. That was the time, you know, British accents were just the thing. And he looked at me and looked me right in the eye and asked me a question that now I look back on, and with, you know, the 20/20 vision we all have in hindsight, can see the reasoning of the question he asked. But at the time I didn't realize it. He stopped me and he said, "Chris, what do you know about the second coming of Christ?" And I was taken aback because he never had asked me, you know, any particularly religious questions at this point, but suddenly I was faced with that question: what do I know about the second coming? Well, I was raised a Southern Baptist. I was raised going to Sunday school every Sunday. What did I know? Well, it turned out to be shockingly little. I told him I could remember. I was expecting it to happen. I figured it was going to happen soon, or that we were living in the days of the last days, and I knew that I wanted to be ready for it when it did happen. But any kind of specifics besides that, I didn't know. Now, he didn't respond to me. He didn't say anything to that question. He just simply smiled and let it go at that. And I thought the question odd, but just dismissed it and went on to the lecture. Now, we got to the lecture. I walked into a room on campus. There were about 20 people. It was a room about this size, about this many people. And I was one of two or three people that were there that were not members. Now, I didn't realize it at the time, but I didn't know where all these people were from, but they're probably the most congenial people I'd ever met in my life. I was bowled over. They were kind, they were considerate, they were friendly, they were willing to talk to me. They didn't seem to be trying to change my mind about anything. They wanted to be my friend. They brought me a Coke. They had cake. They offered me all kinds of things. And I had never had a group of people be quite that concerned or quite that friendly. University of Arizona is quite like this size of this school. In fact, it's even bigger. It was at about 30,000 when I was going there. And so you don't find a lot of overtly friendly people in a large campus like that. At least I hadn't found that many people, and I was really taken aback by these people. And the first night we heard a lecture on the nature of God. Now, wow, what a topic. There's volumes written on that subject, and they had a very effective 2.5-hour lecture, using the Bible quite a bit, mixing a little Eastern thought into it, using a lot of graphs and charts that I had never seen before, but I was duly impressed with their presentation. I went back to my fraternity house that night, as a matter of fact, and I told my fraternity brothers that I found a group of people who could talk about God and religion the way I always thought it could be talked about. They were using their heads, they were using their minds, it seemed like. They weren't just in a philosophical type of lecture. They weren't trying to just stimulate my brain. But at the same time, they weren't on an emotional trip. They weren't just trying to stimulate me emotionally and make me make a decision based on pure emotionalism. And I was impressed. They obviously loved me. They obviously were concerned. And they seemed to have their theology together. It was different, but it sounded good. It sounded logical, really. And I went on to, they didn't have to ask me to come back to the lecture the next night. I wanted to come back. We're going to talk about the fall of man. And we're going to talk about the fall of man a little bit tonight, too. And I'll show you what they believe the fall of man is. And as well, the next night we talked about history, historical parallels. Fascinating. I'd always loved history. And they paralleled it in such a way that it made a lot of sense to history that I thought had never had a lot of patterns to it before. The next night we talked about Christology, the nature of Christ. What was he here to do? Did he do it? What's going to happen in the last days? And the conclusion of this whole lecture series is the last days. What's happening? The days that we live in. Now, I came down to the end of this lecture series. They had used the Bible each night, and they'd used it quite extensively. If you ever look at their book, Moon's Revelation, it's called The Divine Principle. The Bible is used inside and out in that. And having been raised a Christian, I felt like people using the Bible were telling me the truth. What I didn't realize is that I wasn't very up on my context in the Bible. A lot of things were being used, and very effectively, but out of context in many cases. And a lot of things, and in my research and going back over the Divine Principle since and looking at the quotes that they use in the Divine Principle and what it actually says in the Bible, there's some errors. Now, whether that's a printing error or exactly what, it doesn't exactly match up in many cases. But at the time, I didn't realize this. You know, I was attending my regular daytime classes. Now, I had a pretty full load that summer. And it just so happened that every day as I came out of a class, one of my regular classes, there just happened to be a member of that One World Crusade standing outside of one of my classes, who happened to be going the direction I was going, and it was the same guy that I met the first day. And I didn't think about it at first. I thought it coincidental at first, but then I began to realize, no, he was purposely being there. We'd always talk about the lecture subjects we had discussed earlier, and he'd encourage me to be there that night. If that didn't happen, I got back to my fraternity house, and there'd either be a card there, a plate of cookies there, a cake there, something like that with a little note attached to it saying, Chris, we're thinking about you. We're concerned about you. We're praying for you. I'd never been so greeted by a group of people in my life. I never had this kind of interest taken in me. And to say that I was gratified by it is just an underestimation. Because I had been taught one thing in my Sunday schools, and you might have been taught the same thing, that God is love. And I found so much love amongst these people, although their theology was new and different to me, and especially the conclusions of it were new and different, I thought that there might be a chance that God was going to be there. Well, what are the conclusions? What are the bottom lines to this thing called divine principle? Why is the Christian world upset about it? Why is the first time that the National Council of Churches in New York City ever investigated another church organization, the first time the National Council of Churches ever called another church organization not Christian was when they investigated the Unification Church. They simply said it is not Christian. That it's a viable faith, perhaps, but it's not Christian. Why not? When I got down to the end of the lecture series, I realized several things. That the last days were a little later than I thought they were. That we were in a period a little later than I thought it was. And that the same way the Christians had missed the coming of Christ, the Jews had missed the coming of Christ 2,000 years earlier, that it's possible the Christians were going to miss the coming of Christ this time. Remember how, you know, in our traditional Sunday school classes, we talk about the Jews missed it. They were expecting a traditional kingly figure to come and to rule and to lead armies. And when this carpenter came from Nazareth, they refused to recognize him because he wasn't what they were expecting. Now, if I passed out a piece of paper to everyone in this room and I said, tell me what you know about the second coming, I'd get a lot of different answers. I'd get a lot of different conclusions. Now, what if it doesn't happen the way you think it's going to happen? Are you going to recognize it? Are you going to see it? Could we be in the same boat the Jews are in 2,000 years ago? Could it happen differently than the way we expect it? I never simply had even thought about it being possible. But suddenly my mind was stimulated and I wanted to know for sure. And I began to realize something too, that this man named Sun Myung Moon, they didn't consider him to be just any other man. He wasn't just another evangelist. He wasn't just another great religious leader. He was far more than that. But they never came right out and said it. And I'm going to show you how a lot of these things conclude and show you how they come up with the conclusion in the end that Moon is the return of Christ. Now, first of all, I'll have some people that will take issue with me over that point, but bear with me, because I didn't know for sure when I moved in whether they believed that or not. They had left me with every conclusion. In fact, the first question I asked, is, do you believe Moon is the Christ? They left me with a conclusion that I couldn't have drawn it any other way. The answer I got is, Chris, you need to pray about that, and you need to move into our living center so that we can begin to discuss this more. Questions had been raised in my mind. I wanted to know about the second coming. I didn't want to miss it if it was going to happen. And if there is a God, and I truly believe there is, and He is working in this world, and I truly believe He is, then I wanted to know where it was. And if the Christ was back, then I wanted to know about it. I moved in 7 days after I met them. Now, still not knowing whether they believed He was the Christ or not for sure. It didn't take me but about 2 or 3 days to realize. They were first of all referring to Him as Master or Father all the time. And I began to realize that they were closing their prayers a little differently than they did when they were in front of me when I was on the other side. When I was out of the organization, every evening we closed the prayers in Thy name, in His name, and I often assumed they were referring to Jesus Christ when they were closing their prayers. But when I got in, suddenly they were closing their prayers in the name of the true parents. True parents. What in the world are true parents? Moon and his wife are referred to in the movement as the true parents. They're praying in Moon's name. I joined on a Thursday. On Sunday morning, we got up at around 4:30 a.m. I thought, what in the world? I didn't know such an hour existed on Sunday mornings. And we got up that early. We all got dressed up. I didn't know what we were doing. They said, we're going to have a service. And so at 5 o'clock, with the men on one side of the room and the women on the other, and a picture of Moon and his wife right up in front with some flowers on the table, a nice tablecloth, we all bowed 3 times to the picture and read a pledge, which we pledged our lives. We pledged the willingness to die for this organization, pledged the willingness to give it all we had, and acknowledging Moon as the revelator, as the true parent of mankind. And it kind of rubbed me wrong the first time I went through that. I thought, well, now, they wouldn't tell me outright that they believe this, yet once I get inside, then there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I heard a man the other day, or not the other day, it's been a little while back now, named Neil Salonen. He's president of the Unification Church of America, a man I worked very closely with while I was in the Unification Church. He was asked on a radio program, do you believe Moon is the Christ? And I heard him say, well, we believe that he possibly could be, but that he's at least a great prophet. He's a John the Baptist figure, perhaps. This is the pat line they use on the public. Because you as a Christian, if the first thing you knew about the Unification Church is they believed Moon was the Christ and they were praying in His name, you'd be turned off immediately and probably would have nothing to do with it from that point on. So that'll be one of the last things you'll learn about them. But the first thing you'll see is a lot of harmony, a lot of cooperation, a lot of love. People who, I found myself, I said, I want to be like those people. I'd always had high standards and high morals in my life, but theirs were even higher. And I felt like, boy, if there's a group of God's people, I want to be part of those people. So upon moving in, realizing that this organization believed Moon and his wife were the true parents of mankind, the replacement of Adam and Eve, they're going to build the four-position foundation. Some of these things I'll share with you in just a minute in forms of some graphs up here. But I thought I'd better call Mom and Dad and tell them what I'd done. Now, for a second, you're all about that age. Put yourself in my shoes as you're calling home. You're a senior in college, you're president of your fraternity, you're making good grades, Mom and Dad are proud, you're their oldest child, you were an exchange student in high school, things are just hunky-dory as far as they're concerned. Mom has always decided you were going to be the lawyer and your brother was going to be the doctor, and we'd always gone along that track. It was just a typical, wonderful situation. I'd never had a real cross time with my parents. We'd always had a fairly good relationship. So I'm calling home. Mom and Dad, I said, I quit school. Well, there's no response. I said, I've quit my fraternity. I've quit my part-time summer job, which was in a bank, by the way. I had a potential of going into banking. I enjoyed banking at the time. And I said, I've joined an organization that's preparing the way for the coming of the Lord. Now, my parents had been the parents that these people I was talking to were the parents that had sent me to church every Sunday, had taught me to learn to love God and to serve Him. And when I said I was working with an organization that's preparing the way for the coming of the Lord, they went into shock. They didn't say, you know, at first I expected screaming, shouting, gnashing of teeth, pounding on the floor, this kind of thing, but they were in shock. And Mother said, well, Chris, if this is what you really want to do, go ahead and do it. That's not like my mother. Now, my mother is the type that always had the better idea. No matter what my idea was or my brother, she had one better. She's keeping us on the track. She was very opinionated and never lacked in opportunities to express her opinion to us. And for her to say, Chris, if this is what you want to do, go ahead and do it, was not like her. I wasn't surprised when Mother and Daddy called me every day from that point on. At least for the next 2 weeks they did, begging with me on the phone to come home. They said, come home and talk to the pastor about it. Come on and talk to us about it, they said. I'd been an exchange student in high school. He said, we'll send you back to New Zealand if you'd like to go back over there and spend some time. You've been working too hard in school. They said, whatever you want. Let's just think about this. Don't make a quick decision. I'd seen my mother cry perhaps a handful of times in my life. She's a very strong person. She cried every day on the phone when she talked to me. And I guess you could have done anything to me or perhaps to anything else, anyone else in my family, but if you hurt my mother, then it was something very, I just didn't have very much control over my emotions if someone was hurting my mother. And here I was hurting my mother. It was tearing me up inside to know that they were going through this. Why didn't I go home? Why didn't I just at least consider their point of view? Well, I'd been set up for this experience. I'd been set up that this was going to happen. My spiritual father in the Unification Church told me that I had just joined God's organization when I moved in, that this was an organization that was going to do the most dramatic things for God, and that if there is a God, and there surely is, there's also an adversary. There's also a Satan. There's also a Lucifer. And that if I was in the center of God's will by being in the Unification Church, I could expect Lucifer or Satan to do anything to get me out. In fact, he said, I remember him particularly looking at him and says, he'll probably use your parents to try to convince you that this is wrong. Satan will probably use your parents to convince you that this is wrong. Well, what were my parents doing every day trying to convince me that it was wrong? They didn't know anything about the Unification Church, nothing at all. And the more they fought me, the more I began to think, maybe he's right. Maybe Lucifer or Satan is using my parents. Maybe they just don't realize it. They seem to be acting irrationally. And the harder they tried, the further they drove me in, to the point that one day my father said, Chris, as far as I'm concerned, you might as well be dead. He thought that would shock me out. He thought I would come home when he heard me say that. When I heard him say that, I didn't. It sealed me in. Because suddenly, Mom and Dad's love seemed very conditional. They were going to love me just as long as I was doing what they wanted me to do. And this certainly wasn't God's love. If we know one thing about God's love, that it is not conditional. It is given unconditionally. And so my parents threatening me, luring me, trying to force me out, certainly didn't seem like unconditional love to me at the time. Well, I got involved, and very actively involved. I was in Tucson. We were just starting the work in Arizona. I was sent to Phoenix, where I was working with the organization. We had another center in Flagstaff, Arizona. And for the next 2 or 3 months, I learned how to witness. I learned about the divine principles. I began to learn a lot of things. I began to learn how to come up to you and say, "Hi, my name is Chris Elkins, and I'm part of an interdenominational Christian youth project here in the Iowa City area. And we're here working to sponsor drug programs, and we want to start mission projects here. We're interested in seeing kids get off the streets. Buy a flower to support my efforts." It's doing good for the world. And in some cases, it doesn't necessarily have to be Christian. But the fact that it's usually presented that it is Christian is alarming. The tenets that we know to be Christian involved the personage of a man named Jesus Christ. The historical evidence, the spiritual evidence of what he came and what he did forms the foundation of being Christian. A smile on one's face, an attitude, that doesn't make one Christian. Christians should have those attitudes and have those expressions, but just because you have them, that doesn't necessarily make one Christian. The Muslims believe that Jesus Christ was a prophet. The Jews believe Jesus Christ was a prophet, but that does not make them Christian. And so, when you're met by them, when they're offering you the flowers, they have a surprising amount of success. I see them all the time, and they're at my door in Atlanta quite a bit, in a parking lot such as that, and I get all kinds of lines, all kinds of stories, various things. Sometimes they're wearing their little badge, sometimes they're not. I live in an apartment complex that's got a huge sign out in front of it that says no solicitation, and somehow they don't see that sign, that it's impossible to get into the complex without reading the sign. Unless they're illiterate, which I know them not to be, they're just coming in even though, without any adherence to what we've asked, that there be no solicitation in the apartment complex. Now, my first few months and first few weeks, I began to learn a little bit. I began to learn more and more about these things called divine principles and what they were. I began to get more and more emotionally involved with the people. I quit my job. I quit everything. I didn't have an outside source of income. My parents had cut me off. And I was part of a group that calls themselves the family. And I became like a little child again in many ways. Totally dependent. Same way I was when I was a little boy. I was totally dependent on my family for my livelihood, my support. And I became part of a thing called the family. But I want to take a few minutes here and express to you some of the things that is believed by the Unification Church. Now, this is not, we don't have 20 hours to go through a real good presentation of the divine principles. But I want to give you the basis of what all of this is about. What is motivating, or what's the motivating force behind the divine principles? Now, I hope I know how to use this, and I hope I don't run out of cord. Now, let me move this so you can, I guess everyone can see it. Moon basically talks about the nature of God in terms of a symbol called the yin-yang. Now, any of you who have ever studied any kind of oriental philosophy have seen the yin-yang before. It's used very similar to what it's used in Taoism, but there are a few differences to what is how it's traditionally used as far as Moon's theology is concerned. He talks about God in terms of dual characteristics, dual natures. They spend a lot of time developing the idea that the world exists in dualities, and that if the world exists in dualities, God also must have dualities in his nature. That God is masculine and feminine. That God is positivity and negativity. That God is subject and object. That God is light and dark. That God is inner and outer. That God is all of these things that we're used to existing in a complementary form. That God contains all these things in his nature. Well, I didn't find anything particularly outrageous about that. I'd never thought about it in terms like this before, but it seemed okay. And they said that when God created mankind, he created man with all his masculine side, all his masculine images, and he created woman with all his feminine images. Now, man by himself, a man, does not reflect the true, full, complete nature of God. God also has feminine characteristics. Woman does not reflect, the nature of a woman does not reflect the nature of God. But that together, a relationship between man and woman, a loving relationship that could occur there, there is where the nature of God becomes reflected. Because God has the elements of masculinity and femininity harmonized in terms of the symbol called the yin-yang in His nature. Man and woman can have the same harmony, the same kind of love that begins to reflect the full nature of God in a harmonious form. And that the natural outcome of a loving relationship between a man and a woman will eventually be a family. Now, this is a very simple idea, and I just explained it very simply. I haven't really done it justice. But basically, this thing is called the four-position foundation, and is the total basis for the philosophy that the Unification Church teaches. Now, you say, well, there's nothing particularly outrageous about all that. Well, no, there's not. But they take this and begin to build upon it. And they begin to talk about, they specifically get into the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. Because they say that there's something wrong here. That when Adam and Eve were placed in the garden, God gave Adam and Eve three blessings. He told them to be fruitful, to multiply, and to have dominion. And that by being fruitful, He wanted Adam and Eve to become perfect, spiritually and physically perfect. Now, what is perfection would take a long time to get into, but Adam and Eve were to become totally one with God. That this bond between Adam and God was to be strong, and God, the bond between Eve and God was supposed to be strong before they moved to the second level, multiplication. Now, I heard Moon say at one time when he was expounding on a lot of this stuff that Adam and Eve were probably about the age of 12 when they were created. That they were probably, that they were created originally as brother and sister to one another, or in a fraternal relationship. They were not created immediately as husband and wife. That they had to grow, first of all, to become fruitful, or to become perfect, or to become one with God before they multiplied. Because when they multiplied, if this was a God-centered relationship between Adam and Eve, their family would automatically be centered in God. Because all of the bonds and ties to God. And that eventually, someday, dominion would come to the world through Adam and Eve. Because of Adam and Eve and their family, a society would grow from that family that was centered in God. From that society, a nation would grow that was centered in God. From that nation, a whole world would eventually come, all centered in God. And this was God's very simple plan to populate the world with goodness. Okay. But something happens. This world that we live in today, hopefully, is not God's ideal. I hope it's not, at any rate. If it's not, then what happened? This is a very simple idea. Something happened. Well, they introduce another character that I'm going to put right up here, called Lucifer. Now, remember Lucifer, the archangel. Lucifer was originally one of the three archangels, Lucifer, Michael, and Gabriel. Now, Lucifer played a special role, Moon says. You can find a lot of this stuff in the garden story in Genesis. A lot of this stuff is where he reads between the lines. Now, Lucifer had special relationship to Adam and Eve, and that he was to raise Adam and Eve. He was to sort of be over their guardian, watch over them, help raise them into perfection. And then from that point on, Lucifer's name being Son of the Dawn, or Son of the Light, was the one to help raise them into the light. And so Lucifer had a special portion here, but something happened. This very easy plan that has to be explained for just a second. Lucifer became a little jealous of Adam and Eve. You say, now why in the world did he become jealous? Well, say for just a second that I was a father, and I have children, and I have servants. Now, the love I have for my servants can be very strong, very special, very close, but the love I have for my children will be unmatched with any other love bond that I might have. No matter how much I love my servants, I'll love my children in a special way that I could never love my servants that way. Well, Lucifer was a servant of God. Adam and Eve were children of God. Lucifer wanted the love that God was giving to his children. He wasn't willing to accept his position. Now, in this process, Lucifer eventually decided that Lucifer being masculine, that he wanted to move into position where he could receive the love of God as a child. Now, Adam and Eve had no kind of relationship outside of a fraternal one to this point. They had not yet become perfect. They had not yet completed stage number one, according to the divine principles. When Lucifer... Well, let's back up a little bit. There's two trees talked about in the garden. One's called the tree of life. The other's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Those two trees are specifically mentioned in the garden story. Now, Moon says Adam was a tree of life. Eve was a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, remember the commandment that God gave Adam and Eve? He said, "Don't eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for in that day ye shall surely die." Well, now, wait a second. If Eve's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what's the fruit? I mean, it certainly must not have been an apple or an orange or a fruit, that kind of fruit, because those kind of fruits simply did not grow on Eve. Symbolic trees don't grow literal fruits. But what was it? What weren't Adam and Eve supposed to do? What was this commandment all about? Well, basically what it all boils down to, because we could talk about this all night, Lucifer ends up seducing Eve. There's actual sexual union between Lucifer and Eve. That Lucifer, in this union, opens Eve's eyes. Eve suddenly begins to realize that this is her relationship to Adam. And when she had the sexual relationship with Lucifer, in trying to right the wrong she knew she had just committed, she turned around then and seduced Adam. In which case, they began this love process of husband and wife before they were perfect, and the family that they ended up eventually creating was not one that was centered in God, but one that was centered in Lucifer, because he started the whole process in the first place. And when Jesus said, "You are of your father, the devil," he literally means it, that our father is the devil. And that this is really the point at which sin came into the world. It's not that sex is wrong, the misuse of it. And that Adam and Eve fell, and thus mankind has borne a burden because of this fall. We all are born into sin because of this, they say. And so that it was very important to understand what the fall was. Now, you say, how in the world did they deduce that it was sexual? Did it have to be a sexual sin? They use some interesting reasoning. Say I'm a little boy, and Mommy has said, "Don't eat any cookies out of the cookie jar." And I go into the kitchen when Mother's not there, and I've got my hand in the cookie jar when Mother walks in, and I've got a cookie in my hand. What do I immediately do? Hide it behind my back. I hid that area of my body that committed the sin. What did Adam and Eve do after the fall? The fig leaves. They hid the areas of their body that they committed the sin with. Or that is the psychological reasoning that is used there at any rate. So, it must have been a sexual sin. It's something that we have passed from generation to generation to generation. It simply could not, they believe, been an apple or an orange or a fruit of any kind. Because Jesus said it's not that which goes into the mouth of a man that defiles him, that which comes out. Now, I don't think it was Jesus exactly meant it to support that statement, but this is often used to support their idea that it couldn't have been anything they ate. Now, what happens now? The world has fallen. Adam and Eve produced two children, at first at least. One's named Cain, one's named Abel. Now, Cain is a representative of the relationship between Lucifer and Eve. Cain is Lucifer's child. Abel is God's child. He represents this relationship between Adam and Eve, which God originally intended. Now, the world today, Moon divides history from this point on into Cain and Abel's. Everything is a Cain and Abel from that point on. Today, communism is the Cain. Democracy is the Abel. And they trace history from this point on in terms of Cain's and Abel's, or in terms of good and evil. Very traditionally Oriental style in tracing history, and just the battle between good and evil. Moon calls it Cain and Abel. Now, we don't have time to go into history, the whole historical parallels, but basically what they do is divide history into three 2,000-year segments, starting with Adam, taking it down to the time of Jacob, considered the first victor for God. Jacob, it's traced from Jacob then down to the time of Jesus. Jesus being the one potentially who could come and save us. Jesus then down to the time of the present day. They've divided each of these 2,000-year periods and up into separate little segments inside that parallel one another. If we go and say, let's look at what God's doing at this 400-year time period right here, if we go down to the next timeline and pick up the same corresponding 400-year time period, we can pick God's doing the same thing. Or if we go down to this last 2,000-year time period and pick out that 400-year, same 400-year time period, God's doing the same thing again. See, God's a great numerologist. He loves numbers. He loves doing things in terms of time periods. And he's accomplishing a victory at the end of each 2,000-year period. Jacob is the first victor for God. Why? Jacob was Abel. To this point, Cain always killed Abel. Cain always won over Abel. Remember the story of Jacob and his brother Esau? Jacob won over Esau. The first time one of God's guys won over one of Lucifer's guys. So Jacob becomes the foundation for victory for them. It's a very short explanation, but we'll just have to settle for that right now. Then they come down to the time of Jesus. And they say Jesus comes as the second Adam. Now, the second Adam, he's referred to as that in the Bible. He's coming as the second Adam. If he's the second Adam, there also must be coming a second Eve. That they believe it was Jesus' mission, primary mission, to come into this world, take a wife, start a family, and build the kingdom of heaven on earth. Now, he didn't do that. He didn't ever take a wife. He didn't ever start a family. And in essence, they believe Jesus didn't complete his mission. Or further, they believe Jesus failed. Now, they believe it's Jesus' primary mission to take a wife, that there should have been a wife in this position, that Jesus would have started a family. He never did that. They tell a real interesting story that I didn't learn until I'd been in Unification Church, say for, I guess, about a year and a half. But it's an interesting story about Jesus and John the Baptist. It is not Jesus' fault that he failed, Jesus Christ, John the Baptist. But it was John's fault, they believe, that Jesus failed. Now, I don't know what you know about biblical history, but at any rate, Jesus and John have a special relationship that we've never known anything about until Moon has presented this to us. Remember Jesus' mother, Mary, and John the Baptist's mother, Elizabeth. Remember, biblically, we know that they were cousins. Now, they go to great pains to prove that Jesus Christ is simply human, just like you and I. And if he's human just like you and I, then he also has a physical father just like you and I. But who is Jesus' physical father? Joseph? No, not Joseph. But it involves Mary and Elizabeth. You'll find all of this story about Mary and Elizabeth that they present in the Bible, but then he takes it a chapter further. Mary and Elizabeth were also maidens in the temple. It seems that there was a temple function that women served at the time called maidens in the temple. Maidens in the temple were often exploited by the priests of the temple, sexually exploited. And at the temple that both Mary and Elizabeth were maidens in, the priest in that temple was a man named Zacharias. Now, Zacharias was Elizabeth's husband. Their son was John the Baptist. What we never realize is Zacharias also fathered Mary's child. And that Zacharias was the father of Jesus Christ. Now, that set kind of heavy with me because I never had thought about Jesus having a physical father, but I'd been in a year and a half when I heard that. Had I been in one day, one month, it might have been very hard for me to accept it at that point. But Zacharias was the father of Jesus Christ. He was simply human, just like you and I. No difference except he was born without sin. He had escaped this sin that they call original sin. Well, Jesus went to the cross. And they believe that the day Jesus died on the cross, Satan scored one of his biggest victories. It wasn't God's victory when Jesus died. And this idea of the cross, the Christians using the cross as a symbol of victory, they consider it a symbol of defeat. Now, you can't get much more crossways with Christianity than that point. First of all, there are a lot of people who will try to, a lot of Christians who will say, well, Jesus might be human. There might be no divine element in Jesus. There's a lot of Christians who believe that. But when you come down to the point that Jesus didn't complete his mission, or his primary mission, by going to the cross, you cross a lot of people at this point, and it gets to be kind of rough for a lot of Christians to accept. Okay, Jesus didn't do it. Now, Jesus did resurrect, but they believe it strictly spiritually, that he never resurrected physically. Only the spiritual Jesus arose. And that Jesus was never joined with a wife. At least up until recently, he's never been joined with a wife. But they believe that he was joined with the Holy Spirit as a feminine position in the spiritual world. That through God the Father, Jesus the Son, the feminine position of Holy Spirit, we today are a spiritual family in this fourth position as Christians. We're reborn through Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit. Now, I'm sure you've never heard the Trinity explained exactly that way before, But they acknowledge the existence of the Holy Spirit, Jesus Christ, and God the Father. And it looks like it's okay, but this is the relationship they believe they has. Now, in these timelines and time parallels, they come down to a point that between Jacob and Jesus was somewhere between 1,917 to 1,930 years. Somewhere right in there. Now, since God has been doing the same thing in the same length of time every time to bring about a victory, how long after Jesus is it going to take him to bring about the final victory or to bring about the second coming? Probably somewhere between 1,917 to 1,930 years. The new Christ will return. The one that's going to come and build this kingdom of heaven on earth that Jesus was not able to build. The one that's going to start this family that Jesus was not able to start. They ended their lectures with that. Not that, but about that when I heard the lecture series the first time. That Christ returned between 1917 and 1930. Now, if you have any kind of inquisitive mind whatsoever, you're going to say, if that happened between 1917 and 1930, then what happened? Well, first of all, they have deduced that, number one, it will be a physical return, because it's a physical kingdom of heaven that Christ has to build. And the only way we know that physical beings come is to be born. So they deduce that Christ was born back onto earth between 1917 and 1930. And that's the... That if we look into Revelation, it points out that Christ will return out of the east. Now, it often refers to, in other parts of the Bible, coming on the clouds and such as that. We don't have time to get into how they explain away the coming on the clouds and that. But at any rate, they believe that the Christ will be coming out of the east. They believe he'll be male as well, too, by the way. So, it's a male child born between 1917 and 1930. Now, there's a lot of male children born between 1917 and 1930 that could have been the Christ. Who is it? They say, well, since he's coming out of the east, you can narrow it down a little bit further about who it is, about where it is, and who he is. That's, number one, God sends his person into the front line. The front line is always the battle between Cain and Abel. Now, why did I tell you Cain and Abel were a minute ago? Communism and democracy. So it must be a country in the East that's fighting the battle between communism and democracy, between Cain and Abel. Well, when I was hearing it, three countries came to mind. Korea, Vietnam, and China. Could have been one of those three countries. But since this was the Christian Christ, the Christians were expecting his return, he must return to the Christians. Now, of any country in the East, which country has the greatest percentage of Christian population? Korea. Now, they deduce that Korea is the country. A male child between 1917 and 1930, who is it? Well, there's a lot of male children born in Korea between 1917 and 1930, but we can narrow it down even further. When looking at this, if he was born between 1917 and 1930, that means today he is somewhere between the ages of 61 and 48. He's somewhere in that age category if he's alive today, if he's born between 1917 and 1930. If he is alive today, he must have a worldwide mission, an organization that is affecting the world. And like every other great spiritual leader that has ever come, he must be rejected in his own times. Rejected. Now, provide for me a list, if you will, of Korean men born between 1917 and 1930 who have a worldwide church mission organization who are being rejected by the people of their own times today between the ages of 61 and 48. I guarantee you there's one. His name is Sun Myung-moon, the third Adam, the true parent of mankind. And if there is Adam, there is Eve. Eve today is a woman named Hak Ja-han. Their mission, as the true parents of mankind, to establish the four-position foundation on the physical level, to have a family. They're taking their mission seriously. I believe they have 10 children now by this marriage. Now, the true parents are the ones they pray, the name they pray in. They acknowledge Moon and his wife as being the true parents. They believe this man is the Christ. They believe this man is the Messiah. Now, when I first heard all of this and got down to these conclusions and later found out that Moon had been married more than once, it kind of affected me, because the bottom line of membership in the Unification Church is marriage. After you've been in the movement at least, and usually these are the qualifications, at least 3 years you've got to be in the movement. You must win at least 3 new members to the movement. You usually have to be around the age of about 25. You're eligible for what they call the blessing, or marriage. Now, once you become fruitful, that means that you've fulfilled those qualifications, then you can become married in this organization. Now, marriage occurs a little differently here than anywhere else. And let me tell you about the last major one, which was in Korea in 1975, in February of 75. I know several people who were married in that wedding. Moon took 1,800 men and 1,800 women to Seoul, Korea with him. He divided them into several subgroups and went through pretty much matching them up for marriage by going, you and you, and you and you. Now, of course, they had a consultation period. They could discuss this. But now, wait, don't forget, they consider this guy to be the voice of God in the world. This is the Messiah. If God ever, you know, leaned down to me and said, Chris Elkins, you should marry Farrah Fawcett or whoever, you know, would I argue with him about it? There's very few who will reject the match that Moon makes for them. Now, Moon married them in a mass ceremony, 1,800 couples at one time in February 75. You thought you'd been to a big wedding. That is in the World Book of Records as being the largest. Now, 1,800 couples at one time. Why? To symbolize their unity and think of something else. How dedicated are those people that they would let this situation occur, would let it happen? And number three, something that's interesting, the children that come from these marriages. You see, the same way that Jonas Salk had to discover the cause of polio before he could affect the results of it, Moon had to discover the cause of sin before he could eradicate the results of it. They consider the cause of sin Lucifer and that sexual thing that took place there. Now that they've solved that, they can go back and smooth over the problem. They can go back now. When Moon forms a marriage, it is not Lucifer's marriage. When Moon married them, the man and the woman, the family that they create is a very special one. Because that family, those children that come from the marriages Moon performs, and Moon's own children, do not inherit original sin. Now, there's two or three schools of thought in the Unification Church about that one situation there. Do they? Oh, how perfect are they? How innocent are they? How pure are they? Will they ever fall? Well, think about it. Adam and Eve were created without sin. They were created pure and innocent. They fell. Now these kids might fall. But they believe that the product of this marriage will simply be they've eradicated sin from the world, and they'll simply outpopulate us. Moon often uses, and I've heard him use the example several times, of getting a pool of dirty water symbolizing the world. If you start getting clean water and dumping bucket after bucket of clean water into that dirty pool, you'll eventually diffuse out all the dirty water. They're going to start dumping in innocent children, people who don't have sin. And that this is the cause, and this is the major factors in their theology. The bottom line comes to, we can become perfect. We can become to have a nature that we don't have sin. Now I want you to stop and think for just a second. Remember the temptation that Lucifer offered Eve in the garden. I don't care if it was an apple, a banana, an orange, a sexual relationship, or whatever that she was tempted with, that is not important. She was tempted because she was told that if she took or partook of whatever that was, she would have her eyes open. She would become as God. She'd be able to see as God. He promised her perfection. That is exactly the same temptation that Moon offers his members today. It's the very same temptation, but it is so subtle now. It is so wrapped that if you aren't 100% right on, embellished in your faith, and know the Word well enough, this is going to make a lot of sense to you. It sounds logical in a lot of ways. You know, if I use this example a lot. Number one, if you and I were going to walk to the North Pole from here and had a compass, I gave you a compass and I had a compass and yours was right on, it's going to get you there. It's been used before, it's tried, it's true. It'll get you to the North Pole. A relationship with Jesus Christ will get you to the goal, as far as I'm concerned. Now, if I have a compass that's just one little tiny degree off at the beginning, you and I are walking out of here, we're going to walk north to the North Pole, it looks like we're going to the same place. In fact, we'll walk side by side for miles. That one degree won't make any difference here in Iowa City and several miles down the road. But as we get further down the road, our paths separate further and further to the point that because I was one degree off at the beginning, I'll miss the goal altogether. Now, that is my analogy of the Unification Church. One degree off. A lot of it sounds good. Moon has got a phenomenal campaign in San Francisco, where they're planning to feed the hungry, feed the aged, an anti-pornography campaign in New York City, a successful science conference every year.